I will essentially sort of fill in a few details from Mark's talk last week and a little bit look at it from a different angle. So it's a little bit sort of reverse difficulty. I'll do the more tutorial style talk here. So let's start with just laying down some notations. I'm using largely the same notation as Mark did. So the topic of the talk is how do you find out information about matrices that can be approximated by lower rank matrices. And the matrix that we're interested in finding stuff out about is always going to be denoted by A. And it has dimension m by n. And just for concreteness, I'm going to assume that it has more rows than columns. It's just to not have to worry about writing, you know, mean mn and things like that. That's really not an important point. And I write the singular value composition of A in this form, u dv. So u is the matrix whose columns are the normal, d is diagonal, has the singular values on the diagonal, and they're ordered like this, and then v is just a unitary matrix. And the operator norm of A is going to rise a lot, and that's of course simply the largest singular value. And then another object that's going to rise a lot are vectors whose coefficients are random variables. And they're always going to be normalized Gaussians. And each entry is individually distributed. So just for short, I'm going to call such a vector a random direction vector. And sometimes, to eliminate a point, I will work with a vector on unit length. So you just normalize it like this. And that I will denote with a little twiddle. OK, so having laid down that, let's revisit the first problem that Mark looked at. So the goal here is to estimate, or rather to get a bound for the operator norm of the matrix A. And what we have at our disposal is a fast algorithm for computing a matrix vector multiply. So then the general idea is simply to generate a sequence of random vectors. We operate on these vectors by A, and then we want to get the bound for the matrix norm of A. And so we've already seen this problem. And I wanted to go in and look a little bit more carefully at the geometry. And think about what do properties like different ranks of A, how does that influence this computation? And what happens, for instance, let's first look at one extreme situation. If A is well conditioned, so essentially all the columns of A are roughly mutually orthogonal, or they have large angles between all of them. And moreover, every column has roughly the same length. Then what happens if you multiply that matrix A by a vector with random coefficients? Well, you're going to form a new vector that's a linear combination of the columns of A, and the weight's going to be random. But now since the columns of A are more or less orthogonal, this random linear combination where the weights, the square of the weights sum to one, so this vector is going to have essentially the same length as any of the columns of A. So for this particular case, a single observation of A acting on a random vector will give you a certain bound for the operating norm of A. So if you work out the formulas, you see that A acting on omega tilde is bounded from below by the smallest singular value. And then you just extend this formula by putting the same number here and here, and then the condition number pops up. So within the condition number, you get an assured bound for A. Okay. So this is in some sense, a simple situation. And of course, in this case, this is overkill. If you know that the matrix is well conditioned, you can just look at a single column, and that immediately tells you more or less what the how long they are. So the more interesting situation is the opposite extreme. Or rather, the opposite extreme is the trickiest and at the same time the most interesting situation for a randomized sampling method. And then you of course have the ones when it's almost rank one. It has much smaller rank than n. Yeah, but let's start looking at the opposite extreme. So if A has rank 1, then once you apply A to this random direction vector, what you get is essentially, it's exactly this. So So simply the leading singular value, this is a vector of length 1, and then you get the inner product between, on the one hand, the right singular vector of A, and on the other, this vector of random direction and of length 1. So the reason I'm going through this in a lot of detail is simply that once I tell people about this, there's always a lot of confusion about what's your probability distribution of A and things like this. And the theorems will not make any statements for A in the following class. A is just a given matrix. That's not the random variable. The random variable is simply the sampling vector. So in this case, think of it as the right singular vector of A is a fixed direction in space. And we now want to estimate what is the expectation, what do we expect to see when we form the inner product between this vector and a vector of random direction. Because 1 over cosine of that angle is the relationship between the observed, which is the length of A times omega, and what we want to bound A. And of course, what makes things a little precarious here is that this coefficient could be anything between 1 and infinity. So it's not a particularly useful bound, unless you can estimate that somehow. And when we estimate that, we might as well look at the generic situation. It's just as easy. So we call the SVD of A, we write that like that. And then this is the entity that we observe. So in order to estimate this, we simply plug in the SVD. And now this is where the isotropy that several speakers have already talked about, that since omega tilde, its random distribution is that it's a vector whose point tip lies on the units, on the surface of the unit ball, and it's uniformly distributed. Now V is just a unitary transformation, so it preserves surface area on the unit ball. So V transpose applied to omega has exactly the same distribution as omega. So this is what I call nu. So nu tilde here has the same distribution as omega tilde. And then notice that the components of u form an orthonormal basis. So the length of this vector is simply the same as the length of this vector. And this is something that's this little calculus, these steps are very, very useful in analyzing these algorithms, because you can, in a lot of circumstances, you can simply assume that the matrix A that you're looking at is diagonal. And any result you can prove for that case, then simply by a unitary transformations on the left and the right, puts you in the generic situation. So here is the formula for what it is that we're observing. So each new J is a normalized Gaussian variable. Yeah, so the worst case scenario here is the rank 1. So we bound this from below by dropping all terms of this sum except the largest one. And since these terms are actually squared, if you're in a situation where the singular values decay, this is actually not that bad of an approximation. This is sort of typically what you observe. So we bound A times omega tilde from below, like this. And sigma 1 is, of course, just the spectrum norm of A. And now let's look at the denominator. So the denominator is it's a random value variable that has a chi-square distribution of degree n. So its expectation is square root of n. And notice that the standard deviation of the denominator is the fourth root of n. Yes?
In English, the number n is greater than
n? N is typically smaller than n. Is that what you asked?
Yeah, the number m is less than n.
M is larger. The matrix A is tall.
Yeah, I see. But then I don't understand the last part when it is there. So we have a smaller number of components of this vector B nu tilde. And how can we recover the norm out of the one before that? Because T nu tilde seems like the projection of T nu tilde on a smaller dimension.
No, so this is a vector of length n. And then u times that vector is simply, it's a vector in a higher dimensional space.
In a higher dimension?
Yeah, so u looks like this. U is tall. So u of x has the same norm as x for any x. Oh yeah. So let's go back and look at the denominator here. So the expected value is square root of n. And if n is just moderately large, if it's 100 or something, then for practical purposes, this is square root of n. It might be, so say it's 100, then square root of n is 10, and in practice you'll see sort of things between 7 and 13. And if n is larger, then you'll see much less variance. So this is a fairly good approximation. So what you're observing is essentially the spectral norm of A times the absolute value of a Gaussian random variable divided by square root of n. Okay, so now we want to get a bound for this. We want to see what is the probability that the discrepancy between the norm of A and what you're observing is very large. So let's, for a moment, just pick a real number mu. This will be a parameter that later on we can fine-tune to see how precise of an estimate do you want to have. So there's going to have to be a tuning between, on the one hand, how close of an estimate do you want and how high probability do you need for it to be true. So for now, it's a free parameter. So the probability that this happens is certainly smaller than this, because we know that the observed A times omega tilde is larger than or equal to that. So if this event occurs, then certainly this event occurs. And now we can just simplify a little bit. The norms of A go away, and this turns out to be simply a normal. What's the probability that the Gaussian random variable is small? And you just plug this into the, we have a formula for this, and we simply bound e to the minus x squared by 1, and you get the following estimate. Okay, so now for instance, if we pick mu like this, then you find that the following is an upper bound for the norm of A with some confidence. In this case, the risk of failing is 10%, which is fairly high. So this is typically not good enough for computations, but you see the most sort of immediately, the thing that immediately occurs to you is, well, just repeat the experiment 10 times and take the maximum of those estimates. And this will give you a slightly larger estimate, but now the probability of failing is substantially negligible. Of course, as Mark pointed out, it's actually better to use a power iteration, because when you compute A times omega tilde, you have a fairly high uncertainty in what is the norm going to be of that. But notice that in this sort of worst case situation where A has rank 1, A times omega tilde is aligned with a left singular vector. And then, so you sort of have directional information, and you know how the power iteration works. You just keep enhancing that one, that direction. So that turns out to be a little bit more efficient. Okay, so the reason I wanted to go through this in some detail is there are a couple of important observations that are going to pertain to more interesting problems in randomized sampling. The first one is this factor of square root of n. And how does that come in? Well, the whole point of the randomized sampling is that we want it with a single observation. We want to sort of sense all directions. A priori, we do not know the left singular vectors of A. So we want to try to sense them all at once. And the randomized method allows you to do that. But of course, the random vector that you're throwing out there gets smeared across all dimensions. And the higher dimensionality of space, the less weight you get left for each direction. And typically, the expectation is that you get 1 over square root of n in each direction. And the square root here is enormously helpful. But even if you're in, say, dimension a million, you still have 0.001 weight on each direction, which is typically enough. Notice, though, that this can come back and hurt you. That if you're performing the calculations with low accuracy, say you only have 2 digits of accuracy in your matrix vector multiplier, 3 digits, then the interesting information could simply drown out. So there are some limitations for when this will be useful. The other point was that just for purposes of analysis, it's enormously useful to work with these Gaussian random variables because you have the isomer. You have the directional invariance that you can rotate space and everything will look exactly the same. And that in turn oftentimes allows you to replace the matrix A in your formulas by simply a diagonal matrix. Notice though that this is largely it's mostly done to improve analysis, and it is in some sense the optimal choice. But in practice, you can, if it's inconvenient for you to use Gaussians, if you have something else, then a lot of the time you can use other random variables. And in particular, replacing, you don't need a very high-grade random number generator here. But it's, of course, expensive to generate pseudo-random numbers that are very, you know, very good approximations to Gaussians, but you don't need to expend too much cost on that. Okay, now let's talk about something more interesting. So now, instead of just computing or estimating the spectrum norm of A, I actually want to compute the full decomposition of A. And earlier, I just wanted to get a rough upper bound for the spectrum norm. Now I actually want precise approximations. So I'm going to compute these approximations to 5 or 10 digits of accuracy. So this is a much more sharp and realistic problem. And so we have different kinds of approximations. And for our purposes, it doesn't really matter. I'm not going to talk about, if you want to have the QR approximation, you do the following. If you want the SVD, you do that. Because in reality, once you have an orthonormal basis for the columns of A, if A is substantially rank deficient, then once you have an orthonormal basis for the column space, you're essentially done. Because then, so this is what it means for Q to be an ON basis for the column space. And if this is true, if this holds, then simply apply, you project A onto that subspace spanned by the columns of Q. You compute an SVD in that subspace, and then you plug that back in, and you get an SVD of A. And very similar operations allow you to get a QR factorization or anything that you want. So once you have, or at least for my purposes, I'm going to consider it the problem solved once I have an orthonormal basis for the column space. So how do you do this? And the classical numerical analysis answer is, we can use Gram-Schmidt. So you start with all the columns of A, you pick the largest one, well, this is my first basis vector, and then you project onto the orthogonal complement of that, and you just continue until you've exhausted the column space. This works great, but the problem is that it's, of course, quite expensive. It takes m and k operations. And I'm going to present two alternatives that are better than m and k in different environments. And they both rely on randomized sampling. So the first one works for the environment where you have a method for rapidly applying A to vectors. For instance, if A is sparse, or if A can be applied rapidly by FFTs or via fast multiple methods, or something like that. And I'm going to give several examples to illustrate what kinds of matrices I have in mind. And a particularly interesting situation is when A is the inverse of a sparse matrix. So in that case, applying A, of course, what I mean when I say applying A is perform a forward linear solve. I'm going to return to that point. Okay, so in that case, we can reduce the cost so that you essentially get down to simply needing k matrix vector multiplies, and then a little bit of post-processing. The other situation works for a general matrix A, and its cost is mn times log k. And this algorithm 2 makes no assumptions on the matrix at all. So, and this is the one that I think could potentially be very interesting, because this beats a lot of the standard numerical analysis algorithms that are out there. That this is a very classical task. When you have a matrix A, it's a general matrix. We're talking about normal problem sizes, say 1,000 by 1,000 matrix or something. You want to compute its QR factorization or its SVD or something. And you have LA fact and all sorts of algorithms for doing that. But they all cost MNK. But this algorithm costs mn log k, and it's essentially as accurate. It's faster even for these realistic matrix sizes. It's not, the constant in the O is not large. It's not the case that this only beats the standard algorithms at million by million matrices or anything. It beats standard practices at normal sizes, at a few hundred, or certainly a couple of thousand. The drawback of algorithms too is that you don't get entirely full double precision accuracy. But if you're fine with having 7 digits or 9 digits or something like that, then
I think it's worth mentioning here that these algorithms are only better if k is small.
For one, it's true. For two, it depends
so
on
when k starts to get to be on the order of m and n. All of a sudden.
Well, it works fine. This one still wins if k is, say, m is equal to n. It was like n half.
Right, I understand that. But what I'm saying is that for matrices that really aren't rank deficient.
Right. If k is 0.9 times n or something, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's no gain.
And the advantages aren't that large for k equals 0.1, probably either 0.1n.
For the second one, it is large.
Anyway.
I'll show you the timings later. But, no, so it's a good point, but of course, you do need A to be significantly rank deficient, but significant does not mean that K is like log N or square root of N or something. But third N is certainly fine. Okay.
Right.
Yes.
So, if the cost of doing A times X is smaller than MN, numerical analyst would say, well, use, let's say, something like Lanczos.
Yeah.
Right? And then if I look at algorithm one, and your cost, Lanczos is not going to be much that much worse.
Right. So for algorithm one, Lanczos is certainly a very potent competitor. But notice that the convergence analysis of Lanczos is a little delicate, and you can construct. I mean, not only that you can sort of perversely construct, but you do sometimes see matrices which Lanczos does not work particularly well. Whereas algorithm one is rock solid. It has.
It's also kind of hard to compare the two with respect to accuracy, right? I mean, it's not clear to me how to compare. I mean, I know the bounds here, and the Lanczos bounds are quite different.
Right.
So it's not clear to me which one is more accurate given the same time.
Yes.
I don't know how to do this comparison theoretically.
It's hard. I should have mentioned that Lanczos is an alternative in many environments where algorithm one works. But it seems to me, even though it is a very delicate question, that in most situations where Lanczos works, this will do just as well. And this will work in some environments where Lanczos does not perform particularly well. Notice that a clear advantage of this is that it's what they call trivially parallelizable. But Lanczos really needs to do them one at a time.
Yeah. Well, the way people parallelize Lanczos is if they have a big one, A, if you can parallelize one A times X.
Right.
And then people have blocked Lanczos.
Yes. Yes, yes.
There's an entire, 40-year-old industry there.
Right. And this is actually an argument in my favor because this cannot be the foundation of a 40-year industry. It's a very simple algorithm.
Well, then what good is it if it doesn't promote new research?
And of course, all this work, it's not coming out of the blue. There are lots of works preceding from which it has been inspired. But since several people have talked about this history, I'm going to skip it for now. Okay, so let's start by talking about algorithm one. It's the one that I was sort of involved in developing. Algorithm two, I had nothing to do with, I should point out. So I don't want to take any false credit here. Okay, so let's start looking at what kind of matrices am I interested in. So one example is a potential evaluation matrix. So you're given a bunch of charges in one region and a bunch of sources in a different one. And this is a situation that it arises naturally in many areas of physics where you need to evaluate potential fields. Now, of course, typically the two regions are intermeshed. But it arises directly in many areas of physics, and it certainly arises a lot in numerical analysis because these kinds of operators arise in the discretization of integral operators. That these matrices A are essentially off-diagonal blocks for such an operator. And all the properties I'm going to mention about A pertain to off diagonal blocks of a wide range of operators in mathematical physics, like whether you discretize you can discretize a PDE and compute its inverse, then these properties apply to the off diagonal blocks. If you discretize an integral operator for any non-oscillatory problem, that's the big divider, then the things that I'm going to say is these properties are going to be true both about the off diagonal blocks of the integral operator and of that operator's inverse. Okay, so first of all, let's mention that in some cases you know from analysis how to factorize these things. So for instance, if you have a simple harmonic potential, so these are just electric charges like in your left region, and you want to evaluate the electric potential that they induce in the target region, then physics will tell you, well, there's actually a separation of variables method that's called multiple expansions that does this for you. So this, of course, has been known for a long time. And if you want to write it as a matrix factorization, it looks like this. And the point here is not to illustrate, you know, talk about multiple expansions or anything. It's just to say that in some cases, you know from analysis how to do this. So analysis tells you that this is the basis for the column space of A. This is the basis for the row space of A. And once you have such a factorization, you can now more rapidly apply the operator. So essentially what you do is you start with your charge distribution. You then calculate just a few multiple moments. And the number that you need here, k, depends logarithmically on the accuracy that you want. So this is log epsilon, if epsilon is your computational accuracy. So this cost is very cheap. It's simply n, the number of charges, times the number of multiple moments that you want to compute. And then once you have the multiple expansion, you can simply evaluate them at all the target points, also at a low cost. Okay. Another way of doing it is to take this operator A, you can simply compute, use brute force and compute its singular value decomposition. This is another way of getting a factorization that you can use to more rapidly apply the operator. And then you see that the spectrum looks like this, which confirms the theory that your singular values will decay exponentially. And then, of course, once you hit double precision accuracy, you can't really do anything further. And this type of behavior, this spectrum that I'm showing here, this is very typical of any integral operator associated with a non-oscillatory kernel. So if you discretize Laplace's equation using a boundary integral equation, then the off-diagonal blocks of the integral operator will have this type of spectrum, and the inverse of that operator will look the same. And things start to change if you look at oscillatory problems. In this case, it's the same problem, but now I have the Helmholtz kernel. So I have an oscillatory potential, and k is going to be fairly high in the next example. So these blocks have a size 1, and I'm looking at the Helmholtz problem with k equal to 35. So this a fair number of oscillations along each side. But then you see that you eventually get into a region of exponential decay of the singular values, that you have a lot of over one singular values first. But eventually you get into this exponential decay. So even if k is moderate, then you might still want to compute low rank factorizations. Yeah. So the advantage here of analysis, of course, is that you don't need to expend any energy computing these the basis for the column space and the row space. Analysis just tells you what they are. The drawback is that it's a very blunt instrument. You cannot really, when you do the analysis, encode exactly what's the geometry of your source region and your target region. So you overestimate the ranks substantially. And in many cases, you don't have the analysis to do this. But for the forwards integral operator, if the kernel of your integral operator is the single layer potential, then what I just showed you worked fine. But if it's the inverse of that integral operator, you do not know, you don't have a formula for its inverse. And the SVD is sort of the complement of this. It's very expensive to compute, but it gives you absolutely optimal ranks, and it can always be done, provided that if the matrix has a low rank approximation, then the SVD will give it to you, and it's the best one you can get. And randomized sampling will be a way to combine the advantages of both of these approaches. It's going to be quite cheap to compute, and it gives you very close to optimal ranks in essentially all situations. Okay, here is the example that's perhaps the most relevant to this workshop. So now suppose that, let's consider a discrete Laplace operator. So in this case, I'm doing simply the 5-point stencil on the square grid. So here, I have simply a square grid, like this, and I study a conduction problem on this. So each bar in this grid has conductivity 1. And if you want to solve the equilibrium conduction problem, you apply some heat sources, and you want to find what are the temperatures that equilibrate this problem, then you're going to end up with a matrix that has L as its coefficient matrix. And of course, L also rises if you discretize the Laplace operator on a square. Okay, so in this case, L is a sparse matrix. It's full rank, more or less. Oh, it is full rank. It's very ill conditioned, but it is full rank. And rank deficient 1, I guess. But it's not L that's interesting to study from my point of view. It's L inverse. Because if you invert L, it so happens that the off-diagonal blocks L will have exactly this exponential decay property of the spectrum that I like to exploit. So, okay, so L is the 5-point stencil. I invert the Desmoid matrix A. And I'm now going to look at an off-diagonal block, A14. So it's a 600 by 600 matrix. And its spectrum looks like this. So you see its numerical rank is really very low. At 10 digits of accuracy, the rank is like 15 or something. And this is exactly what's underlying the stuff that Shiv was talking about last Thursday. This is what he exploits in the algorithm. And even after you perform operator algebra on such matrices, so you have two such inverses and you multiply them, the off-diagonal blocks of the result will have exactly the same behavior. So this is what underlies all these sort of fast inversion schemes for discrete Laplace operators. And when you try to think about why this is, it's at least my first thought is, well, the inverse of the discrete Laplace operator, it should be an approximation to the inverse of the continuum Green's function, which I know to be smooth away from the diagonal. So it's not strange in that respect. But then the second thought is that, well, this should only be valid up to the accuracy of my discretization. So in this example, I'm looking at a 50 by 50 grid. So the discretization parameter H is 1 over 50. So I don't expect this to be accurate to more than 1 over 2,500. So I should not. This should not be true beyond 3 or 4 digits, but it's straight as a line all the way down to the computational precision. So there's something much more going on than simply the fact that this approximates a smooth continuum object. And to even drive that point home, next I looked at the same discrete Laplace problem, but now I assign a random connectivity to each bar. So there is no smoothness, and it does not at all look like a discretization of a difference operator. And look what happens. So this is for the 5-point stencil with constant coefficients. This is the 5-point stencil with random coefficients. So there's really something much more fundamental going on. And these are the kinds of properties that you can exploit when analyzing these discrete Laplace operators and other types of network matrices.
Can you just remind the random coefficients you put on the weights?
Yeah.
The weights on the grid.
Right, so each bar here, it's connectivity. So it's a fairly kind case in that I just picked it uniformly at random between 1 and 5, I think. A harder problem would be to pick it uniformly at random between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the 3. But that would deteriorate the problem a little bit, but that still would not really mess up the picture much. Yeah.
Sorry, I misunderstood. What's random here? The weights in the stencil that approximates the Laplacian, or the
yes.
conductance?
Think of the physics, or at least for me, that's the easiest. So think of this as it's a number of points. I connect each point
sure.
with a metal conductor. And I adjust the thickness of those strings at the random. So the first row.
So this is actually saying something about the conductance in the system.
Right.
Okay.
So
it's
so
not saying something about discretizing the Laplacian.
It does not at all say anything about
that. Okay, that was
correct.
My misunderstanding.
Yes. Yeah. So if you take this physical grid and you apply the unit load here, it essentially says that over here, your solution will look fairly, it won't look smooth, because it will have this kind of fine variation,
mm-hmm.
but it will be low rank for some reasons that I've thought a lot about. I have some intuition about it, but I can't really formalize it.
There's people that actually sort of talk about this for a living.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because they're random walk in random environments.
Yes. Right. So another advantage of this is that sometimes it's not the, well, so if you work at discretizing PDEs, then it is actually the inverse that you want. Because if you have the inverse, then you can very rapidly apply that to a new data vector and you get extremely fast and robust solves. But a lot of the time you want to use it to estimate singular vectors, so eigenvectors, of these network matrices. And for eigenvalues that are not too large, you can use shifted power iteration for this. Because if you have an efficient representation of the inverse of L, you can quite cheaply compute the inverse of a shifted version of L. But it does not work so well if you push mu large in one direction. So in that case, you're sort of looking at essentially a Helmholtz problem. In which case you get oscillatory behavior. But what's been surprising in our numerical experiments is that it actually survives surprisingly long. That eventually it scales, the inversion schemes, the asymptotic complexity does grow as mu grows, and grows very bad. But it takes surprisingly long until you get into that bad behavior.
So what does surprisingly long
mean? So what I've looked at in detail is studying scattering problems of a contour
mm-hmm.
in 2D. This is 2D. And up until about 200 or 300 wavelengths across, it works fine. Beyond that, it starts to scale. You start to see that it eventually hits cubic complexity with the wave number. But up until about 200 or 300, it essentially behaves the same way as the Laplace problem. So it's surprisingly robust. Okay, now let's talk about a little bit more detail about how to actually do this. So this is the same algorithm that Mark talked about on Friday. So we're given the operator A, we know how to apply it to a vector. And also in some cases when I say this, what I mean is that I can perform a forward solve by an iterative solver or something. So then the question is, how do I get a basis for the column space of A. And the algorithm is the same as it always is. It's you generate these random sampling vectors omega, you act on these by A. So each Y here is now a random linear combination of the columns of A. So now assume for a second that A has rank 10, say. Then when you have 5 random linear combinations of columns, okay, you can certainly not expect to construct the basis for the column space. Once you hit 10, it's possible. But if you were lucky, then these 10 random linear combinations will form a basis for the column space. And as you go beyond 10, it's intuitively clear that the likelihood that you'll be able to span the column space will increase as you go beyond 10. Now, the remarkable thing is that the speed by which you approach certainty beyond 10 is to me very surprising. That you can prove that if the rank is k, once you go 20 beyond k, so k plus 20 sample vectors, you will have done it to probability 1 minus 10 to the 17. So it's essentially dead certainty. In practice, in these situations where the spectrum decays exponentially, k plus 2 or k plus 3 will do it for you. It will get you the basis for the common space that's accurate to 10 digits of accuracy. So it's really amazingly efficient. It's almost as good as if you knew the left singular vectors, right? If you knew them in advance, you would still have to perform matrix vector multiplies to compute. That's get you A. But even if you don't, you just lose a tiny amount. Okay, so let's see how this performs in the same example that I talked about before, reevaluate potentials. Before I can show you the performance, I have to describe what are the variables that are going to be plotted. So first of all, the first quantity is the following. So I compute the first L random linear combinations. I simply perform Gram-Schmidt on those random linear combinations to find a orthonormal basis for those vectors. And then I project. I see how much is left of A once A has been projected onto the orthogonal complement of that. That is the exact error. That's how much I really missed A. Of course, this is exceedingly expensive. So in practice, I cannot compute this. This is just to investigate the algorithm. In practice, what you can compute, though, is something like this. That you can see, so you compute your random linear combinations one after another. And you can keep updating your basis for the first, an orthonormal basis for the first L of the random linear combinations. And then you can project, see, if I take 10 more, how much does that add to my basis? And I essentially stop once I get to the point that the next 10 don't add anything more. So that's something that you can realistically computationally do. It so turns out that instead of 10, you can do 2 or 3, but that's, I can't prove that, so that's not how I would design the code. But empirically, it turns out that you can have 3 here instead. So FL is something, it's an estimate of how well you're doing that you can actually compute. EL is something that you can only compute in toy cases. So let's see how this performs.
If M is very large,
yeah.
In this, is it essential to do the Gram-Schmidt, or can you get by without doing it?
Well, the likelihood is that well, you could do something in a randomized sampling on those entries, but for that you would need to know something about. Right. Unless you know something about probably. In many cases, yes.
That's what I would have thought.
Yes. I know probably carefully. It's an interesting question. Yeah. Okay. So this is sort of the core slide of this presentation. The red crosses are the singular values. Okay. That's how good you could approximate. If you have all the information in the world and you want to construct the optimal rank k approximation, you would get to the red crosses. And the dashed line is how well the randomized algorithm does. The green one is the one, if you actually know everything, you can observe how well are we doing. The blue one is the one that you could actually do in practice, even for a very large matrix. So the blue one is what you would observe. And it essentially exactly follows the spectrum. You're like 2 vectors behind at any point. So it's really doing remarkably well. And you might think that, well, maybe I just cheated and this was a particularly lucky realization. But the experiment that I just showed you, you could go and you could code it up in MATLAB in 20 minutes and you can run it for yourself. So it's amazingly simple and it's very simple for you to verify that this actually works. If you're willing to trust me, I ran it a million times, the same experiment, to see how many random vectors do I need to get. So in this case, the exact rank is 19, the numerical rank to precision 10 to the minus 10. and about 0.5% of the times, I actually needed just 19 random vectors. More typically, I needed k plus 1 or k plus 2. Occasionally k plus 3 or k plus 4, never more than k plus 5. So it's really doing remarkably well. This is the more difficult problem. This is the higher, this is the one with an oscillatory kernel that I demonstrated. Now the rank is much higher, but it still performs fairly well. Notice, let me point out one important point about this graph is the gap between these two. This is important. I'm going to return to it. Actually, I think I'm going to get to it right now. Yeah, I'm going to return to it a little bit later. For now, let's give you, what does the theorem say? This is the theorem that Mark proved, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. It essentially tells you that, okay, so Q here is the O(n) basis for the random linear combinations that I've constructed. And this is how much have I missed of A. After L steps, how much of A is still missing? And that's bounded by sigma k plus 1 is the very optimal amount. And compared to that, I'm losing square root of L times M. So if you're looking at a million by million matrix of rank 1,000, say, then you would lose maybe 4 digits. Which, in many cases, where you can compute with almost double precision accuracy, this doesn't really matter. And the thing that really saves you is that in many applications, the singular values decay exponentially. So you can kill off this factor by just looking at going a little bit further into the spectrum. And from a mathematical point of view, what's interesting is that this theorem makes, first of all, it makes no assumptions on A. It works for any spectrum. Regardless of what the spectrum of A is, it works. And the probability here depends only on the difference between the number of random samples and the actual numerical rank k. So f here does not depend on m and n, for instance, which it would be very easy to believe that m and n would sort of, there would be some way in which this would deteriorate for large matrices, but there isn't. It simply depends on the difference between the number of random samples and the actual numerical rank of the matrix.
So good. This must be quite pessimistic, I guess, right? This number of, if all the singular values are the same, this becomes very, very large, right? Yeah. I mean, the trivial log zero approximation will do better. But so there must be huge room for improvement.
I'm not really sure. I mean, that's, unless you know something about the spectrum, the situation with this method would perform poorly compared to yourself, for instance.
No, I'm comparing the thing about lunch.
As you said, it's very difficult to compare with lunch. Because notice that there's no assumption on the spectrum of A or anything here. But where this bound is a little bit bad, and actually, that's accurate. The algorithm performs badly in this case. Is if the spectrum looks something like this, but it actually, say this is 10 to the minus 4 or something, and you want an approximation that's almost 10 to the minus 4. In that case, you will not, because you do not have a decay. So in this case, sigma k plus 1 might be 10 to the minus 4, but so are all the other larger singular values. In that case, you will lose something like that factor. That is what you observe experimentally. That is the discrepancy why, in the graph I had before, the randomized effort in it, it did not get down to 15 digits. It sort of leveled out at 13.
Isn't the ratio between the sigma k and sigma k plus 1 somehow the more relevant?
Yeah.
So if you have some estimate that sigma k, if you know that the spectrum decays exponentially, then you can construct, you can from this theorem derive corollaries. But you can amortize this factor by going a little bit further.
So then the exponential decays, that don't you only mean that the ratio between sigma k and sigma k plus 1 is some constant that you can, that somehow
right.
It seems like that's kind of the only thing. I mean, you don't care about the rest of it.
Yes, you can definitely do
necessarily the rank or numerical.
Well,
this term.
Well, so in this term, the way it works is it's simply, it's the first line. So A is M by N, and K is N the integer. Okay, so then it formulates a statement in terms of sigma k plus 1.
Okay. So I think Mark had referred, suppose you don't know the numerical rank.
Yeah.
Before you do this. And
yes.
You were going to tell us about how to estimate what
yes.
the rank is. Is this the algorithm that you just tried for?
So we don't have results, but this is something that I'm working on, or rather that Aaron is working on. So the question is what, so here I just, this is just something I, you know, it's the first thing I thought of. Instead of computing EL, which I don't know in the generic case, I'm computing FL. FL is an observable, it's not computable. And FL, if you look how this develops, that would be the cutoff criteria. At what point do you stop? If I see that I'm not adding anything to my basis, how long do you keep going?
So you just keep on adding vectors till you hit
right.
the numerical.
So let's look at, so in this case, so you're observing FL, which is the blue line, and you want precision 10 to the minus 10. So you see here that at like something, k equal to 19. Now you're doing better than 10 to the minus 10. But then to get some certainty, you certainly want to go a few steps more and see that nothing more is happening. And a related question is, how do you compute this orthonormal basis? That, so the way I'm writing it here, you're really computing the QR factorization of YL when you go from L equal to 12 to L equal to 13. This, of course, very expensive and you can't do that in practice. But it's the only way that you can immediately say is absolutely numerically stable. So the question is, how do you more efficiently update? What kind of pivoting do you actually need here? It turns out that in practice, actually completely unpivoted, you can do completely unsafe, and it happens to work, but this is something that you have to think about, and somebody is thinking about it. So, yeah. That's work in progress. So this is the theorem for now. This is what Mark proved. And let me just, I think we've already covered this. Right, so we already talked about this, but this factor square root of Lm could in certain cases cause you a problem. Specifically, it could cause you problems if you want an approximation that's very close to what's actually optimal. Say, another situation where this could be is that your operator has an exponentially decaying spectrum, but your computation, your matrix vector, multiply has only four correct digits. In that case, the randomized method cannot get you all the way up to four digits. You will lose a bit. And this is an important point. So I'm not going to prove this, of course, since Mark did it, but just to give an indication of how it works, notice that if you write this the same way we did before, so y here is a random linear combination of the columns of A. You can do the same trick before, that you rotate your coordinates on the right to line up with the right singular vectors of A. In that case, y is simply, you can write y simply as a linear combination of the left singular vectors of A with weights that are on the one hand these Gaussian variables, the new j's, and on the other hand the singular values. You see that in a case where the spectrum decays, there will be a huge weight on U1. U1 will contribute a lot to every single vector that you generate. So the chance that you're going to miss it, that you're somehow not going to see U1, is entirely negligible. And once you have a good approximation for U1, you project orthogonally away from that. And then you're certainly going to see U2. So you, within a couple of steps, you're going to pick up U2, and you project away from that. So it really has nowhere to go. If you think about it, it is actually quite natural that these random linear combinations, they are going to lead you, particularly in the case where the spectrum decays exponentially, going to be extremely efficient. Yeah, I am running out of time, so let me just mention quickly, what is the alternative in the case where you cannot perform fast matrix vector multiplies? And I just wanted to mention this to connect the two topics together, that the environment that I've talked about now is that we generate an orthonormal basis for the column space of A from the product of A and a random matrix. And the reason that it's fast is we can apply A rapidly to these vectors. Now, suppose you cannot apply A rapidly to anything. Then it so happens you can construct a random matrix that has enough randomness that all these nice properties that I described are preserved. You have, again, sort of the uncannily accurate capturing of the left singular vectors. But you can do this in such a way that you have enough structure in omega that you can very rapidly apply it. So in this case, it's the dual situation, that instead of being able to apply A rapidly, you now have a situation where you can apply omega rapidly to rho of A. And this is how you get O of Mn log k complexity. And this is, of course, the Elan-Chassel idea. It's the same type of matrix that you use. And this is the speed up. Okay, so this answers your question, Joe. This is the speed up of the algorithm by Tigert and Liberty and Rocklin. So this is the speed up. Here's the rank. These numbers are the size of the matrices. So you see, you get very substantial speed ups, even for entirely normal size matrices and ranks. There is 500, it's not close to 1,000, it's certainly not close to 4,000. But it's not square root of 4,000 either. So.
Alright. Does it decline with k?
So again?
As the rank becomes larger.
Yes. So of course.
Why does the speed up getting smaller as k becomes, as the rank becomes larger?
Because if k is, just take the extreme case. If k is, if the matrix has full rank, then you have to perform the ground Schmidt orthogonalization anyway at the end. Like in post processing, it takes as much time.
That's the square factor.
Yeah. But essentially, the post processing. Once you have the random linear combinations, you have to do something with them to get the factorization. And that cost will take as much time.
And that's what you were saying, that in numerical experiments, you've seen that you could maybe avoid that.
No, this is a fundamental issue. I guess that's a sign of it. We can take that after the talk. Okay, I'm essentially done. So the point is just that these randomized sampling methods work very well, but they actually work almost as well as the best possible approximation. They're much cheaper and they have a very nice property that you don't need to think. And thanks for your attention.